Welcome to Business by Design, a podcast that explores the evolving nature of design leadership and how to scale design's impact in the world. Business by Design is brought to you by Tech Circus, leaders in curating inspirational content for inspired professionals, and me, your host, Martin Dowson. I care deeply about the impact that design can have in the world, and as a designer, psychologist, and management consultant, I'm acutely aware of the fact that this impact is more often than not mediated through business. In this podcast, we will address the need for more business acumen in design careers, especially at a leadership and executive level. We will talk with CDOs, design directors, design educators, academics, and consultants, exploring how each of them see the future of design leadership and its impact on the world.
What is the auteur in design? Mm-hmm. So I stated that I see that we have diluted the idea of the designer somehow. It has been lost, and now we have to find it again. We have to find our mother tree, the roots of our discipline. And that's what I'm looking for.
In this episode, I have the honor to talk with the mother tree of design, Dr. Anne Stenross. It's a conversation with a design leader who's steeped in design history through her family and through her own work and studies. In this conversation, we explore where design may have lost its way. Whilst I'm exploring the gaps in the business confidence of design teams and design executives, my call for that confidence at times seems too simplistic next to Anne's deeper perspective on how design leaders can elevate design within organisations. This is a conversation about reclaiming mastery, our inner voice that guides our designerly intuition, and being confident and true to the fact that design is not a step-by-step process, it's exploratory along curved paths that meander towards a deeper truth. Tapping into your own authentic vision, which Anne says is what designers are truly loyal to, and how that can help your progression as a leader and a person imbued with design craft. We talk about whether being a chief design officer is a useful ultimate aim for those of us seeking such mastery. Honestly, this conversation is one that has many, many levels, and I'll be listening back to it again and again. My recommendation is to sit back, really open up to what Anne is saying, because this is not your normal design playbook. And definitely take some notes, because you're going to want to follow up on some of these themes and explore them more deeply yourself, as we did outside of the recording. For that reason, this episode is a bit longer than others, but it's worth it. So for now, let's jump straight into my conversation with the mother tree of design herself. Welcome, Anne Stenross. It's really great to have you here. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, Martin. It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, I always like to let the listeners know how I've met my guests. And Anne, you and I were introduced by the super connected Tom Scott of Fearless. He knew that I was looking into the rise and fall of in-house design teams. And we'd been specifically talking about the role of design executives and chief design officers, and how they help establish design maturity in organizations. And Tom said to me, you have to meet Anne. She's been writing about the different types of CDO, and she was the CDO of a city. And I was like, okay, now this is something I have to hear about. Because one of my first UX managers or leaders was an architect by education, and a UX director by trade, Carol Zerka. And I absolutely loved that perspective that architecture brought into our world of digital design at that time, and the perspective it offers to everybody. So I really had to meet you. I was very grateful for the introduction. So really excited to be having this conversation with you today. We're going to be talking about the future of design's impact in the world. And I think it's a great chance to explore this from your perspective as an architect, a consultant on design from Coda, the CDO of Helsinki, and now your work in academia. It would be great if you could just, you know, give the listeners a bit of an introduction to how, you know, how you've come into the world of design and what you're up to at the moment now.
Oh my goodness, it's too long story for this talk.
Okay, the condensed version then.
Condensed version. But recently, the older I become, I have noticed that there is a thing that has given me a kind of head start, namely that I'm in a second generation of designers. My father he's an architect, emeritus professor, and my mother is one of the renowned Finnish furniture designers and interior designer. So when I was a kid, I used to get into this kind of discipline since my childhood, because there were discussions around that every day in the dinner table. So and I'm fast learner, so I suppose I was a little bit ahead of my peers when I started my studies. And also yesterday, when thinking about this interview, I thought about that, wow, I was sort of, how should I say, proofreading my father's lectures and talks when I was 17, 18, because my father, he comes from a Swedish-speaking family. And my mother always said that your phrases are too long, too complicated. Please, Anne, check what he's talking about. So saying this, the whole thing, design or architecture or leadership, is for me a lifelong learning journey. I mean that I can't separate my life from what I'm doing in a professional way. And that is sometimes difficult for other people to understand that this is me when I'm talking about architecture or my role as a leader or the next phase, what I want to do, because I'm sort of thinking that there are these, like in martial arts, you have these belts. First you get the white one, then the yellow, orange. Up you go to the ninth level. Number nine is the black belt. And it comes from that. Why it's black? Because it has collected all the dirt on your way up to the top of the mastery. So you don't wash the belt, you know, all the battles, all the victories, all your experiences. But the beautiful thing is that what comes after the black belt, when you have mastery in your discipline or in your craft, a new white one, you will get a new white one. And I'm in the phase of my life now that I have got my new white one after my long career in creative leadership, in corporate life and in the city. So I have started my journey with a new white one. Wow. The road is open. I can do whatever I want to achieve the next black one, hopefully.
That's amazing. I didn't, you know, I hadn't really thought about what happens after you achieve your black belt, but I'm really intrigued and interested in the concept of mastery as well, having done some work in personal development as well. And I worked under a coach called Michael Neal, who did a whole course on mastery. And it's a really interesting concept of, you know, what you can actually learn by teaching. And when you go back to original practices and the foundations, having had your full cycle, you see a totally new insight into those original core foundations. And I love the idea of mastery. I think maybe that's something we could definitely touch on for like a whole separate episode.
Because it means that you have all that old mastery with you, but you are heading to a new journey. And you have to take it step by step, be humble enough to take it step by step, because you don't know the road. It's not the old road, it's the new one. And you definitely don't know where you are ending up. It's like when I did my doctorate thesis, I started from the idea of the concept of space, the theory of space. But 3 years later, I was writing about the meaning of the place, completely different story, because I didn't know where it will take me. But the idea that is important here is that we creative people, we have this true north, our north star or lighthouse, a kind of inner insight or ideal or vision, whatever you call it. So that will give the guidance for us if we listen to that. But many, many people, they are so blurred with everyday things that they don't listen to the quiet voice that is their intuition, where to go, what kind of steps to take next.
And this was one of the things that I was so fascinated by in reading some of your writing. We'll include links to this in the show notes. The article, the Lost and Found, about authorship in design, one of the reasons this really spoke to me is because this podcast theme is about, is all about whether design has actually grown up enough and whether it is business mature enough. And as I've been exploring this theme with some people, there's a reaction I get to it as I'm saying, I think we need to know more about business. I think that we need to go back to some principles, some core things about design. And as an industrial and product designer, you knew about the materials of production, and those have changed now. Now you are designing inside a business, and that the materials that you're using are process and policy and people and things like that. And the reaction I sometimes get to this is, but what about who we are as a core, as a designer? And they worry that they're giving themselves over to other disciplines or giving away design craft. And there's something in your article I thought, wow, this is really challenging to me as somebody saying we need to learn more about business. You actually specifically said in this article about, you know, the evolution of design directors who are kind of giving over to the needs of the organization, and that we're losing some sense of authorship. I thought that was a fascinating area. How do we get the balance in this new world? That's what I'm interested in.
Well, I think that if we can here solve the problem, we can publish a book immediately, and that will come the best.
It's a deal. Done. One. Great.
Let's do that. Yeah. But seriously, I have been wondering already years ago. I think it was 2015 or something like that. It was a European Union event around design, and I think it was BIDA that was arranging it or something like that. It was in Brussels, and there were all the people listening to. And then I said that I don't trust design thinking anymore as such, meaning that even how we draw the curve, it's declining. And I dare to say that, and then I was explaining why that is not enough to solve the problems at that time, and not enough definitely today. I have always been ahead of time, sorry to say. But then, you know, the audience and the organizer, they were a little bit worried what will come out of this show now. But the next speaker said, I fully support Anne's point of view. And then the third came, I fully support Anne's point of view. But nobody didn't dare to say it aloud, because it was a kind of status quo thing that we all trust design thinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But the limitations is there that it's a process. And creative thinking is never ever a process. It's stepping aside, it's stepping backwards, it's rumbling here and there, and it's it looks like a chaos for an outsider. But like I said, if you have the true north, definitely you will take it to the goal. But to have this trust that somebody can take a kind of chaos to the goal in a company, in a corporate world, oh my goodness, who can give you that kind of trust? I was among the lucky ones while I was working for Kone the elevator and escalator mm-hmm. company. The CEO gave me the permission. He didn't realize it. Of course, I have to earn that trust. But later, years later, when I saw him by accident, I told him, listen, thank you. You never, ever mm-hmm. touched my vision. Because the only thing that creative people are loyal is for their vision. They are not loyal for organization. They are not loyal for any other purpose of the company. They are not definitely loyal for people. No, they are loyal mm-hmm. for their vision. And if you don't take care of your own vision, your lighthouse, nobody is going to take care of that. So in my part, I think that the deeper you go into yourself and understand what you want to do as a creative, the better mm-hmm. job you can do. But you have to be honest for yourself and everybody else. And I think that's called character building in corporate
world
or in leadership. You have to develop yourself as a leader in mm-hmm. every step to be convincing. And you have to, of course, build your competence and have the skills and know the core of the discipline and all that. But that's fine. But if you don't take care about your character, yourself mm-hmm. as a leader, what kind of leader mm-hmm. I want to be, what kind of leader I am, where I'm heading for as a person, as a leader, then nothing good comes out of that. It's only trivia that comes out of that. Because as much as you challenge yourself, you challenge other people. And when I said that I inherited this lifestyle to be a creative or designer or architect, whatever you call it, it means that my level of ambition has always been very high. I compared myself to my father, to my mother mm-hmm. and their peers, not mm-hmm. the peers of my own age, not the students, but the way above that. So as I said, that the question that you phrase was about
this balance.
Yeah.
I guess it's coming from a perspective. I think one of the interesting things about, I also agree with you about design thinking seen as a process. It's an observation I had was that there was a similar thing going on with UX, and we have user-centered design as a process. It was, then we had customer experience as well, which business wanted to hear about and know about. And how do we deal with that? And every time one of these themes was picked up by business as being, this could be useful, then all of the disciplines scrabbled to become, quote unquote, more strategically important, or to train this out, or to, you know, do more around this. So design thinking was one of those super shots, right? It was, and if we go back to IDEO, it was a useful way for IDEO to continue to serve sell services, right? And to package things up a bit more.
But
it was a business package.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Because design thinking, how it was used and how it was talked about, it was like simplified Chinese. It was easy way to explain what goes on in a creative process when you try to create something new and maybe together with the clients, etc., etc. But it was too simplified. And that was the problem. Because then the outcome was also sort of mediocrity or simplified version.
Mm-hmm.
Not the richness, the real richness that we can see in the world. But the thing is that the good thing with design thinking, though, is that it was a kind of way to train business people to understand at least a bit how we approach things and how creatives do things. So it was a shared language, but as I said, a kind of too simplified language.
Yes. And there was, I think, in that moment, while design seemed to become more understandable, we also, I think we also lost sight of where and when it adds what kind of value. And there's something you wrote about that was reflecting on Esslinger's work in 2009. You're talking about how he had articulated these kind of four or five different types of designer. And I've been going through this as well, I think, in some of the work that I've been doing, which vastly oversimplifying things, but by reminding ourselves that there is production level design and there is strategic or provocative or groundbreaking type of design. And the production level design still needs to happen. And yes, you will cut your teeth in that and you will hone your discipline. It won't always light up your lighthouse, right?
Mm.
But you will learn some craft. But when you get to leadership position, that is when you need to start to try and straddle these things of what is production and what is something more strategic. I think the Esslinger quote you had was about classic designers, artistic designers, designers in a corporate design department, and then the highly creative designers. So it was this really interesting distinctions between them. I thought that was quite interesting because of the need for the designers in the corporate design departments to accommodate for the business, I guess, a bit more.
Yeah, and then I think that I added the fifth one because the original book that Esslinger wrote was in 2009, so quite a while ago. Mm. I added the fifth one, design thinkers, that we do have today. But after this, when I went through, because I love to read the old books, because, you know, you always should discuss with wiser people. So I consider my readings as a dialogue with the wiser ones. So I wrote before I read this list by Esslinger, I wrote, I think, six different chief design officer personas of the future.
Yeah.
Okay. So okay. I was doing a kind of groundwork, how I can see the CDO's role in the future. And frankly, I got inspired because I have a discussion with Tom at one point. Mm-hmm. So he asked me how you can see it. And I thought, okay, wow, I have to figure out. And I created four different scenarios of the future. And then I created four different personas plus two extra. But later, after reading Esslinger, I added two other ones into that list, namely Transformer. And that is related to this complexity thinking. And then Warrior, and that is related to inclusive thinking. And here I can read a little bit about this Warrior that is my favorite, because this is what I see where we can create really change in the future as designers and creatives. Now, the persona's name is Emma, and she's living in Berlin. Emma is a designer empowered by minorities and vulnerable people. She sees herself as a voice of those who are unable to speak. Her mission is to make the world more diverse, equal, inclusive, and just. She is volunteering in different projects from environmental to social sustainability, and her passion is co-creation together with people. Currently, she is involved in a feminist city project trying to make local neighborhoods safer and more meaningful from a female perspective. Emma has a warrior spirit. I love this, you know. I love sheroes. Not only sheroes, but sheroes.
Sheroes,
yeah. And mentor's advice, or her motto, Emma's motto is, we have a once-in-a-century opportunity to turn our cities into something better, less divided and more inclusive. Shame on us if we fail to grasp it. This is something that Richard Florida recently said, actually. Now it's the time, or it's too late. And then I'm reflecting to year 2035. So about 10 years, 10 plus years from now on. And I'm reading now from my text what Emma is doing then in the future. In 2035, Emma is the first chief inclusive officer, CIO, of the city of Berlin, being responsible for the program to prioritize diversity, equity, and inclusion in the citywide approach among communities, services, and neighborhood development. Her local activist initiative, City Life Matters, We Are the City, has been copied around the world as an example how to co-design cities with people. Emma is the youngest person to get the gold medal of the City of Berlin for being a role model in radical urban activism. And Emma's hero is, of course, Jane Jacobs. The Just City is owned by the people who contribute to co-create them. And the amazing thing is here now, when I'm reading this, I wrote this like half a year ago or about, a little bit less than a year ago. I'm doing what Emma is doing now. Gosh, I didn't realize, but while I was reading this, because what I'm trying to put up a project here in Helsinki and maybe in some city in Poland to co-create together with young people a kind of safe space, city as a safe space for them.
Wow.
So
this is like your this is the white belt. This is the next step.
Yeah.
This is the next cycle of mastery,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Where
your ultimate step for the warrior profile is not to become the chief design officer of something, but is to be doing something that achieves the vision, and her vision is for inclusivity. So her role is chief inclusion officer. Yeah. I think I've been reflecting on this with a couple of people about, I've been noticing some of the really good emerging design leaders that I've seen who now no longer have design in their title. And I think that's super interesting. So I've seen some in the digital space, I've seen some people go on to be chief product officer. And I'm like, that's great, because what you're doing is you're bringing all of your design mastery skill and you're integrating some other things. And when you, specifically when I think about where they're doing that, I can see those individuals have got a mission, a personal mission. And it's not about attaining a design hierarchical title. It's about taking on a role that can achieve and have influence. And they bring their design mastery with them.
Yeah, it's more like seeing oneself as a hero or as a hero and carrying on a kind of torch that you have learned from generations before. Like Jane Jacobs, for example. She was a warrior of her own time when she was the first talking about that the cities should be created by citizens, that they are the city, the people who are living there. Not the planners or anything top down, but the people itself, the citizens. So I think that if you are sort of aiming towards your intuition, to your lighthouse, it pays so much more for yourself throughout the journey than if you are aiming to some kind of role. I mean that you will get another hat. Well, I got my doctorate hat. I really had a black hat in my wardrobe that I have never, ever used since. I got it already in 92. So who cares about hats? But I care about myself. What kind of person, what kind of legacy I'm going to leave? And also, I think that if you understand this idea of a hub tree or mother tree, so that the forest has these big trees and they are sort of supporting their siblings, the tiny ones, through underground networks of fungi and all that, giving nutrition and maybe some kind of advice that we can't read and can't understand. So I think that it's far more important to to sort of aim to become a hub tree and share your wisdom and knowledge and understanding than have this black hat in the end.
Oh. Yeah. So this is, I mean, this is something we talked about before, this idea of the mother tree. And this is coming from some of the work that you've been doing and exploring and thinking through in terms of the design of cities and the emergent design of cities, as well as understanding, if I understood you correctly, tapping into a new intuition, not a new intuition, sorry, tapping into another intuition, another intelligence, which is a nature-based intelligence. And the reason why I wanted to ask about this is because I think what you just described there with our warrior, our warrior designer, was taking design into a kind of systemic impact, and not just trying to design a single solution. And I think this is one of the things we have a challenge in business, which is problem, boxed up solution, and we kind of forget that business, society, organizations are all part of a system. And I think that thinking, that system thinking, is missing in business a lot at the moment. Now, before being able to solve for that, I think actually what I was hearing from you about the way that city design is being evolved, I think there's huge amounts that business needs to learn from that. And I think that this architecting of cities in an emergent and nature-based way is probably going to teach something for us in business as well. So could you share with us this new view of the mother tree and nature intelligence that is trying to be brought into how we design our cities? Because I think that would be super interesting.
Thank you. I started this journey literally the 1st of January this year when I took a piece of white paper in front of me. It was Sunday. I still remember that. So I had plenty of quiet time for myself. And I was drawing a kind of map. And somehow I put it into the middle of that map, I put well-being first, thinking that we have a kind of well-being crisis because of this pandemics and because of all kind of crisis, climate crisis, health crisis, social crisis, democracy crisis, you name it. We have plenty of them. And people feel kind of that they are lost. The future is very fuzzy for all of us. We don't know what is really the next something. And so I was drawing a map because I used to sail. So I know that if you want to navigate, you have to either create your own map or rely on somebody else. And because there's nothing available. So I thought, let's make a map for myself. And then I remember the old Aristotelian idea of eudaimonia. You know, the happiness that is based on activity. So that if you follow the virtues or virtue ethics, so that you try to do good for people and good for nature and good for everybody, so perhaps you end up to kind of idea of happiness in your life. So I put the eudaimonia in the middle. There was well-being, eudaimonia. And then I started to think about what are the elements for well-being. Well, of course, mental well-being, emotional well-being is one, but then it's also physical well-being, your health, and social well-being. Cities are all about social well-being. They don't realize it, but it's the very element. And then the fourth one is something that I learned from Japanese language, or from that who is the famous filmmaker, that Miyazaki, I think it's Miyazaki from the Studio Ghibli, you know. So he said that there is a word in Japanese called ma, emptiness, and the emptiness, this ma, is as important as action in his films. because it's the gap in between accents.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and then something start again. You know that there might be a picture where there is just clouds floating on the sky, and the main character is sitting on the field, surrounded by flowers and looking at the clouds. Nothing happens, but a lot happens. So I was looking for the fourth kind of element, that is this kind of oneness with nature, or kind of a spiritual connection to your surroundings. Something that is your private, personal, existential space, so to speak. So I created the map, and then I thought that, okay, how can I apply that into the city scale? And then the idea of this human nature connection, how we can rebuild this human nature connection that is actually the source of our well-being. Coming from Scandinavia, it's so obvious to me that when I step outside the door, there is nearby nature. There is blue space, there is green space, I can make my choice. But now, because of the pandemics and I haven't traveled so much, I have been taking walks next to the water or into the in the woods. And I realize how strong source of well-being that all is. Now, then the second, the next phase was that I remember reading about Howard Gardner's Multiple Intelligences. His book in 1980s was mind-blowing because he said that, listen, when we educate kids in at school, they all have multiple intelligences. And they were seven different categories. Could be musical, could be kinesthetic, could be verbal, blah, blah, blah. But they are all different. And we should support all these intelligences. And 2 years later, he added the eighth one, naturalistic intelligence. And he said that this is a kind of intelligence that some people have a very delicate ability to read the different birds in the woods. They can see the forest and the trees at the same time. They can read patterns from the nature. And I thought, yes, I have been there. That's me since my childhood. And I was so happy that I thought, okay, I'm going to create this nature smart city, whatever it is, based on the idea that if we follow our DNA and ideas of biophilic thinking or biophilia, biophilic design, biophilic architecture, and then I started to browse all these things. And it's a wonderful, wonderful new world that I found. There are actually a network of biophilic cities already. Biophilia meaning that we have this innate connection to nature. We are part of the nature among others. And I mean, it changed my perception of the world as such, that if we can live in harmony with each other and with the nature. So we have a possibility, a hope for eudaimonia being happy in the end.
And we are absolutely seeing all of the signals very clearly now that the natural system within which we exist is rejecting the artificial systems that we've put onto it, right?
Exactly.
So we're only just beginning to talk inside of corporate organizations about systems thinking and about the fact that the business is an organization, is almost an organism. It behaves as a system. And I think that for many people in design, going all the way back to the what is this problem with the balance between quote unquote business thinking and designer's creativity. It's that business has been built off this theory that you that there's strategies that you play out and that they you just run those strategies for 10, 15, 20 years, right? And you just keep getting success off the back of that. And success looks like growth. But growth in any natural system has to always be balanced, yes. Right? Any one thing cannot grow to the exclusion of other things.
You can't overgrow. And it's natural.
You can't overgrow. Yeah, there's a balance. But every organization that is a business for the last 20 odd years has been only looking after its own space and trying to grow within its own space.
Yeah. And compete.
So
no collaboration.
And compete.
Compete internally within the organization. That, you know, it took me years to calm down from that competition after I left the corporate world. Mm-hmm. Frankly, 3 years. Mm-hmm. Because of the... how should I say, this culture that put you into a position to achieve more and more. But sometimes, you know, good enough might be even a greater achievement than something grand.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a role for, do you think there's a role for design to play in helping a shift in this? I can see, because city planning is already an urban space planning is already a 15, 20, 30, 40 year horizon, because it has to be. But business seems to have this horizon that is, you know, sometimes 6 months, sometimes 2 years, but never much more than that. Right? The longest cycle is the venture capitalist who wants their return in 5 years, right? That's the longest cycle there is in business. Yeah. But if city planning and urban planning and design is taking such a longer view, do you think that these perspectives might permeate back into business? I mean, we're creating these spaces and you as businesses and organizations have to start to be a part of this system. Do you think there's something that we can bring these two thinkings together?
Well, I think that there already has been a change in a mindset, because recently I have been thinking in terms of eyes. I mean that I have a list mm-hmm. of eyes, words mm-hmm. starting with I. So, and uh-huh. And why I did that, because I have been thinking more and more that intuition could be the language that we all should listen in the future more and more. I think that intuition and imagination they are the only tools that will take us you know, over these crises. It's not any process, not just rational thinking. Of course, we will need critical thinking and science and all that to support. But where we are heading for, we need intuition and imagination. And I started the list with intuition because that's a kind of primary way of thinking. When we are kids, we sort of rely our intuition, and then it's lost when we go to the school. But it's the authentic source of information for our imagination. Well, then of course we collect information. We need inspiration as an engine or force or source for imagination. And yet, while we are collecting all these things and navigating with our intuition, then somehow we get an insight, a kind of conclusion or a picture of the whole. And out of that, we can create ideas and inventions and eventually innovations. But we need intention and ideal to supervise the direction. So this was a long list, but I try to understand in terms that how we can navigate towards the future, the fuzzy chaos that we can see now, because no process will take us there. Not the scenario process, no strategic planning, nada. It doesn't help because, you know, we don't know for sure. We have seen now when we have went through the pandemics that anything could happen And it could happen within the 24 hours time. So to prepare our mind towards the future, they say that now every company should do a future foresight. They should create scenarios. Yes, that was already in 1960s or 70s when Shell started to do that. That is already old-fashioned way to do it. But just today, I, by coincidence, met a young friend of mine, a designer, who was born in Israel, and then he got married with a Finnish lady, and now he's living in Finland happily with the family. So he has also started this kind of imagination-based workshops, just, you know, out of nothing. And he explained me, he has a very strong army background, actually. And now he relies on his imagination, and he's trying to help others to understand that if you let this imagination free within yourself, you are more able to face the future. You are more creative. You are more, how should I say, prepared to solve any kind of complex problems. And I thought, wow, we are on the same journey, although we started it without knowing about each other. But this meaning that there are tiny, tiny signals. We are ahead of times. Mm-hmm. There are tiny signals that the more you rely on this list of eyes, starting from intuition, the better tools you have for the future. And that is something related. Wonderful. I don't know, maybe I'm going to write another article about that, how it applies or how it works together with this nature smart thinking. But it has something to do with that. We haven't used our full capacity to solve problems or to create anything. So the thing is that, like you said many times, that we are living the times of systems change or systemic change.
Yeah.
And if we think about business, design, the world, crises, frankly, it's a system of ecosystems. Whatever we do, it's a very dynamic thing. If we touch one thing, we shake the whole system or ecosystem.
Yep.
And we have to be aware of that. What is our responsibility? Because when we started this discussion about lost and found, what is the role of design in the future versus what it has been? And what is the authorship? What is the auteur in design? So I stated that I see that we have diluted the idea of the designer somehow. It has been lost. And now we have to find it again. We have to find our mother tree, the roots of our discipline. And that's what I'm looking for. And I think it is somewhere there, starting from intuition and imagination. But how you can convince business people, the corporate culture, that, wow, you need this people who are talking about intuition and imagination, that's the difficult part. But if you can become this kind of creative content curator, so to speak, in this orchestra of ecosystems, so that you become a conductor, you are responsible for the rich sound and the tempo, but yet at the same time, you give space for each and everyone to have their solo and show their competence and creativity throughout the orchestration. You will be quite close to what I think that the future will be.
Well, I think that's a beautiful, beautiful vision for design leadership in the future, and now as much as possible. So thank you for that. That's beautiful. Anna, there's so much more we could that we could talk about and we could explore. the idea of the mother tree, this source of wisdom, but also this connectedness is so root and fundamental for me, I think, when we think about systems and systems of change. It's been really inspiring to hear about how, as an architect of spaces for humans to live in, there's so much inspiration in those thoughts about how we can think about business as well. The connecting to the nature smarts, I think, is a reaction that more business will need to do as well in response to all of the climate emergency, the global crisis in terms of reacting to the way the world is changing, evident in things like COVID as well, which has required us to pivot and change so much. But also in this search for meaning that people are looking for organizations to be more meaningful. But without, I think businesses don't really understand, or the boards of businesses don't necessarily, they're not tapped into the intuition about what that means. So they have vision statements and mission statements, but still their own, not necessarily connected enough within an ecosystem. So if this space of city design, of urban design, can start to show us a place, an ecosystem within which we should exist, I am very hopeful that businesses will begin to find their place there. When you were saying about Kona and the CEO, that trust he put in you, or that space that he allowed you to have, there are very few companies that are doing that, aren't there, that are saying, actually, I'm going to trust this intuition, I'm going to allow for that creativity. I mean, I'm only thinking of in history, you know, the history of Braun, but maybe not so much now. Philips seems to have continued the legacy. IBM seems to have picked it up again in terms of how it's using design internally. But there's very few companies around the world of scale who are trusting that. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that it was Tom who mentioned to me, I think, that he Googled and found that there are about 20 chief design officers in the world. And I was at that time the only female one as a chief design officer of the city of Helsinki. So, you know, there are not too many. And I can see that the numbers are declining. It's like when I started at Kone, and it's a technology company, I realized that on the top of the technology companies, the female, they represent something like 9 to 10% only. And at that time it was increasing, so it was heading towards 11%. But now I think it's coming down again. So I can see that this is what has happened to the chief design officers. It was going upwards, let's say 10 years ago. But now it's declining, and I don't know really the reason. I think that there is another CDO that has replaced the chief design officer, namely chief digital officer. Because when the digital transformation came into an agenda of the companies and corporate culture, so they didn't focus anymore on design only, but they started to do everything around the digitalization. So I think that there is, unfortunately, it seems that there is always one theme that is on their agenda, so that they can't have two horses taking the carriage to the same direction, so to speak. There is always one. But I think that is it a kind of Asian, Chinese wisdom that you have several horses, and if one is stepping aside, you know, you still have three of them, and in the end, the final one take you to the destination or whatever. So I think that design can't do it alone, I know for sure. I saw it.
Sure.
But if we pair with, let's say, the chief digital officer, the chief inclusive officer, the chief, you name it, we can do it. We can co-create it. Yeah. We can train the people to understand yeah. our point of view. So it's not anymore a kind of solo thing. Rather, it's, like I said, you can train, curate, facilitate, you can navigate. But basically what I have said to young leaders when they ask my advice, I said, let them shine. If you make everybody else mm-hmm. shine, you can do whatever you want to.
Yes. And I think there's also this, there's also something in your allegory about the warrior designer profile, who took their mastery of design and applied it to the problems they wanted to solve for. And so their evolution in role in that profile there was to be the chief inclusive officer of Berlin, right?
Yeah.
Not yeah. the chief design officer of Berlin, i.e. design's not the thing.
No.
It's not the end goal. But if we can get more people to have that mindset, to understand that mindset, if we can bring more of what you call the authorship into design, then the challenge for designers is to follow their vision, follow their intuition, and take their design with them into wherever that is. And I think that's the fallacy of some corporate hierarchies, is that you're looking for the chief of what you do. You know, you want to be the chief financial officer, the chief design officer, the chief... Take your authorship and apply those skills to whatever it is that needs to be done.
Yeah.
That seems to be your challenge for the warrior designer.
Yeah, I think that's very well stated what I was thinking about. Then I want to mention one more thing about this design authorship, because auteur as such was a word that appeared in, I think, in 1960s in France, when the movie makers, they thought that the Hollywood movies were following too literally the books, you know, the storyline of mm-hmm. a book, the characters there, etc., mm-hmm. etc. And these French filmmakers, they said that there should be the authentic voice of the creator, of the filmmaker, visible in the film. So it was a kind of reaction against this kind of, design thinking in filmmaking. Let's put it this way. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. and I think that this kind of warrior designer can take this responsibility and show his or her voice in what he or she is doing. To have the courage to stand behind what I'm saying, or to show that walk the talk, or how you put it. I mean that there must be some kind of balance between your values and what you are doing. Mm-hmm. Because that makes yeah. the responsibility, the breach of responsibility between you as a maker or creator, you as a mm-hmm. creator, and what you have created.
Yeah, yeah. So I think you've laid out a really a great and important and significant ambition for designers in terms of looking at their future as design leaders. My encouragement, I guess, would be that hone your craft. If you're at that junior level, you know, the roles that come up aren't always going to enable you to have that full impact that you want to. But there's learning inside every job and role that you can take on. Hone your craft, hone your discipline, but never let go of that vision and that reason why you wanted to be. And feel driven to be in design in the first place. When you get that chance to lead, I'm hearing from you, Anna, you're saying, light people up, let people be their very own light, and enable those people, and then take your mastery to another level. So you know, every time you're looking at a new opportunity, you're looking at a new chance to refine what it is that you know and what you think about design, and to take it up to the next belt, the next belt, the next belt. And even when you get to that black belt, I'm hearing from you, Anna, there's a whole nother level of mastery to come to where you really can be looking at, if you can see beyond the hierarchy inside business and actually look at where the problems are that want to be solved for and take your design to those spaces. That's what I was hearing.
Perhaps we should set up a belt academy for designers. See what I mean?
Love it. Yes, the design dojo. Yeah. There we go. The design dojo. Yeah. You heard it here first.
Yeah, let's do that. It's going to be
Anna,
fun.
I think we should. That would be great. Yeah. Anna, thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy exploring this with you. Having read some of the things that you've been expressing and writing about, both on authorship and Nature Smart City, there are so many levels for people to take away from that, wherever they are in their design career, whether they're just leaving design education and going into their first roles, or whether you're first time being a design leader, or whether you're thinking through what your next role is as a design executive and where you're going to have impact. I think there's something for everybody in this conversation that we've had. And I've really enjoyed exploring this idea of intuition, imagination, and levels of intelligence that you've been exploring. And you've been a great example of the mother tree, the wisdom that we can all draw from, multi-generational wisdom from your family through you onto here. And I'm just so thankful to be able to get to spend some time with you to do that. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you, Martin. It was a lovely conversation. And I think I learned several good things during our discussion today, because I didn't realize that I have started my warrior white belt already.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so next time when we discuss, hopefully I have my orange belt on way or something like that.
Great. Yeah. Great. Yeah. Orange belt level 2. The next level. Wonderful.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Business by Design. Don't forget to check out the show notes for links and resources from our guests, and a link to the fabulous Tech Circus, who produced this podcast. Tech Circus are leaders in curating inspirational content for inspired professionals, and this podcast is just one of many events that they produce for the product, tech, and design community. I'm your host, Martin Dowson. And if you'd like to hear more content like this, then please do follow the podcast. And also take a moment to subscribe to our newsletter, where you can find out more about upcoming shows and, really importantly, how to connect back with me and the team so that we can hear your feedback and suggestions for future episodes. I'd really like to hear more from you, our listeners, about who you'd like to hear from next. If you subscribe to the show newsletter, you'll also get to hear about the Business by Design conference that we'll be running in November, where we deep dive into this over 3 days of awesome speaker-led content and a day of practical workshops with industry leaders in building business-confident design teams. Until next time, thank you for listening to Business by Design.